9. Neither of us was ready to do what we had spoken of doing, or even to think about it yet. There was the matter of the heifers, strayed or stolen. Of course, I wanted to ride with him to look for them, and he wanted me with him. So we went back to the stone house and mounted, along with Alec and a couple of other young men, and were off without another word about what had happened beside the ash brook. But all that long day, from time to time I would look at the green vales, the willows along the streams, the heather in blossom, and the early yellow broom flowers, and up to the blue and brown of the great hills, scanning for the heifers, but at the same time afraid of looking, afraid of staring too hard, of seeing the grass blacken and the trees wither in an invisible flame. Then I would look away, look down, clench my left hand to my side, close my eyes a moment, try to think of nothing, see nothing. It was a weary day, fruitless. The old woman who had been charged with guarding the heifers was so terrified of Kanik's anger that she couldn't say anything that made sense. Her son, who should have been watching over them in the pasture near Drummondland, had been up on the mountain hunting hares. We found no break in the fences where the cattle might have got through, but they were old stone fences, with palings along the top which could have been easily pulled out and replaced by thieves covering their tracks. Or the heifers, still young and adventurous, might have simply wandered off up one of the glens and been peacefully grazing away somewhere on the vast folded slopes of the East Shear. But in that case, it was odd that one of them had stayed behind. Cattle follow one another. The one pretty young cow left, shut up now, too late, in the barnyard, mooed mournfully from time to time, calling her friends. Alec and his cousin Doric and the old woman's son were left to search the high slopes, while my father and I rode home a roundabout way that took us clear up along our border with Drummond, keeping an eye out for white cattle all the way. Now, as I rode, whenever we were on high ground, I stretched my gaze westward looking for the heifers and thought what it would be like not to be able to do that. Not to be able to look. To see only blackness, no matter how I looked. What good would I be then? Instead of helping my father, I would be a burden to him. That thought was hard. I began thinking of things that I would not be able to do. And from that, began thinking of things that I would not be able to see. Thinking of them one by one. This hill. That tree. The round gray crest of Mount Aerne. The cloud over it. The twilight gathering round the stone house as we rode down the glen towards it. Dim yellow light in a window. Roni's ears in front of me turning and flicking. Branty's dark, bright eye under his red forelock. My mother's face. The little opal she wore on a silver chain. I saw and thought of each separate thing, each time with a sharp, piercing pain, because all those little pangs, though they were endless, were still easier to bear than the single immense pain of realizing that I must not see anything, that I must see nothing, that I must be blind. We were both very tired, and I thought perhaps we'd go on saying nothing, at least for one more night, that Kanik would put it off till morning, and what would morning mean when I could not see the light above the hills? But after our supper, eaten in weary silence, he said to my mother that we must talk, and we went up to her tower room where a fire was laid. It had been a bright day, but a cool one, the windy end of April, and the night was cold. The warmth of the fire was very pleasant on my legs and face. I will feel that when I can't see it, I thought. My father and mother were speaking of the lost heifers. I gazed into the fire as it caught and flared, and the weary peacefulness that had taken hold of me for a minute slipped away. Little by little, my heart filled up with an immense anger at the injustice of what had befallen me. I would not bear it. I would not endure it. I would not blind myself because my father feared me. The fire leapt up along a dry branch, crackling and sparking, and I caught my breath, turning towards them. Towards him. He sat in the wooden chair. My mother sat on the cross-legged stool she liked, beside him. Her hand lay on his knee. Their faces in the firelight were shadowed, tender, mysterious. My left hand was raised, pointing at him, trembling. I saw that, and I saw the ash tree on the hillside above the brook writhe, and its branches blacken, and I clapped both my hands up over my eyes hard, pressing hard, so I could not see anything but the blurs of color and blackness that you see when you press hard on your eyes. "What is it, Auric?" my mother's voice. "Tell her, father." Hesitantly, laboriously, he began to tell her what had happened. He did not tell it in order, or clearly, and I grew impatient with his clumsiness. "Say what happened to Hamnida. Tell what happened by the Ashbrook," I commanded, pressing my hands to my eyes, closing them tighter, as the awful anger swept through me again. Why couldn't he just say it? He mixed it up, and began again, and seemed unable to come to the point, to say what it all led to. My mother barely spoke, trying to make sense of all this confusion and distress. "But this wild gift?" she asked finally, and when Kanak hesitated, I broke in. "What it means is, I have the power of unmaking, but I haven't any power over it. I can't use it when I want to, and then I do use it when I don't want to. I could kill you both if I looked at you right now." There was a silence, and then she said, resisting, indignant, "But surely..." "No," my father said. "Auric is telling the truth."
"But you've trained him, taught him, for years, ever since he was a baby."
Her protests only sharpened my pain and rage. "It wasn't any use," I said. "I'm like the dog, Hamnida. He couldn't learn. He was useless and dangerous. The best thing to do was kill him."
"Auric."
"The power itself," Kanak said. "Not Auric, but his power, his gift. He can't use it, and it may use him. It's dangerous, as he says, to him, to us, to everyone. In time, he'll learn to control it. It is a great gift. He's young. In time. But for now it has to be taken from him."
"How?"
Mother's voice was a thread. "A blindfold."
"A blindfold?"
"The sealed eye has no power."
"But a blindfold? You mean when he's outside the house, when he's with other people?"
"No," Kanak said. And I said, "No, all the time. Until I know I'm not going to hurt somebody or kill somebody without even knowing I'm doing it till it's done, till they're dead, till they're lying there like a bag of meat. I won't do that again. Ever again. Ever." I sat there by the hearth with my hands pressed to my eyes, hunched up, sick. Sick and dizzy in that blackness. "Seal my eyes now," I said. "Do it now." If Mella protested, and Kanak insisted further, I don't remember. I only remember my own agony, and the relief at last when my father came to me where I sat crouching there by the hearth and gently took my hands down from my face, slipped a cloth over my eyes, and tied it at the back of my head. It was black. I saw it before he tied it on me. The last thing I saw. Firelight, and a strip of black cloth in my father's hands. Then I had darkness. And I felt the warmth of the unseen fire as I had imagined I would. My mother was crying, quietly, trying not to let me hear her cry. But the blind have keen ears. I had no desire to weep. I had shed enough tears. I was very tired. Their voices murmured. The fire crackled softly. Through the warm darkness, I heard my mother say,
He's falling asleep.
And I was. My father must have carried me to my bed like a little child. When I woke, it was dark, and I sat up to see if there was any hint of dawn over the hills out my window, and could not see the window, and wondered if heavy clouds had come in and hidden the stars. Then I heard the birds singing for sunrise, and put my hands up to the blindfold. It's a queer business making oneself blind. I had asked Kanik what the will was, what it meant to will something. Now I learned what it meant. To cheat. To look. One glance, only a glance. The temptations, of course, were endless. Every step, every act that was now so immensely difficult and complicated and awkward could become easy and natural, so easily and naturally. Just lift the blindfold, just for a moment, just from one eye, just take one peek. I did not lift the blindfold, but it did slip several times, and my eyes would dazzle with all the brightness of the world's day before I could close them. We learned to lay soft patches over the eyelids before tying the cloth round my head. Then it did not need to be tied so painfully tight, and I was safe from sight. That is how I felt. Safe. Learning to be blind was a queer business, yes, and a hard one. But I kept to it. The more impatient I was with the helplessness and dreariness of being sightless, and the more I raged against the blindfold, the more I feared to lift it. It saved me from the horror of destroying what I did not mean to destroy. While I wore it, I could not kill what I loved. I remembered what my fear and anger had done. I remembered the moment when I thought I had destroyed my father. If I could not learn to use my power, I could learn how not to use it. That was what I willed to do, because only so could my will act. Only in this bondage could I have any freedom. On the first day of my blindness, I groped my way down to the entrance hall of the stone house and felt along the wall till my hands found Blind Catterd's staff. I had not looked at it for years. My childish game of touching it because I wasn't supposed to touch it had been half my life ago. But I remembered where it was, and I knew I had a right to it now. It was too tall for me and awkwardly heavy, but I liked the worn, silken feeling of the place where I grasped it, a little higher than I would naturally have reached. I stuck it out, swept it across the floor, knocked the end of it against the wall. It guided me back across the hall. After that, I often carried it when I went outside. Inside the house, I did better using my hands to feel my way. Outdoors, the staff gave me a certain reassurance. It was a weapon. If I was threatened, I could strike with it. Not strike with the hideous power of my gift, but a straight blow, simple retaliation and defense. Sightless, I felt forever vulnerable, knowing that anybody could make a fool of me or hurt me. The heavy stick in my hand made up for that, a little. At first, my mother was not the comfort to me she had always been. It was to my father that I turned for unwavering approval and support. Mother could not approve, could not believe that what I was doing was right and necessary. To her, it was monstrous. The result of monstrous, unnatural powers or beliefs. "You can take off the blindfold when you're with me, Auric," she said. "Mother, I can't." "It is silly to be afraid, Auric. It's foolish. You'll never hurt me. I know that. Wear it outside if you have to, but not in here with me. I want to see your eyes, my son." "Mother, I can't." That was all I could say. I had to say it again and again, for she cajoled and persuaded. She had not seen Hamnita's death. She had never gone out along the Ashbrook to see that ghastly, blasted hillside. I thought of asking her to go there, but could not. I would not answer her arguments. At last she spoke to me with real bitterness.
"This is ignorant superstition, Auric," she said. "I am ashamed of you. I thought I had taught you better.
Do you think a rag around your eyes will keep you from doing evil? If there's evil in your heart?
And if there's good in your heart, how will you do good now?
Will you stop the wind with a wall of grasses, or the tide by telling it to stay?"
In her despair, she returned to the liturgies of Bendramen that she had learned as a child in her father's house. And when I still held firm, she said,
"Shall I burn the book I made you then? It's no use to you now. You don't want it. You've closed your eyes. You've closed your mind."
That made me cry out,
"It's not forever, Mother."
I did not like to speak or think of any term to my blindness, of a day when I might see again. I dared not imagine it, because I could not imagine what would allow it, and feared false hope. But her threat and her pain wrung it out of me.
"How long, then?"
"I don't know. Until I learn..." But I didn't know what to say. How was I to learn to use a gift I couldn't use? Hadn't I been trying to all my life?
"You've learned all your father could teach you," she said.
"Learned it only too well." She stood up then and left me without another word. I heard the soft swish as she threw her shawl over her shoulders and her steps going out of the hall. She was not of the unyielding temper that could hold such anger long. That night as we said goodnight, I could hear in her voice her sweet, rueful smile as she whispered,
"I won't burn your book, dear son, or your blindfold."
And from then on she did not plead, and made no more protest, but took my blindness as a fact and helped me as she could. The best way I found to be blind was to try to act as if I could see, not to creep and feel my way about, but to step out, knock my face against the wall if I met a wall, and fall if I fell. I learned my ways about the house and yards and kept to them, but used them freely, going outdoors as often as I could. I saddled and bridled good Roni, who was patient with my fumbling as she had been patient with it when I was 5, and mounted her and let her take me where she thought best. Once in the saddle, and out of the echoes of the walls of the stable yard, there was nothing to guide me at all. I might be on the hillsides or the highlands, or the moon for all I knew. But Roni knew where we were, and also knew I was not the thoughtless, fearless rider I had been. She looked after me and brought me home. "I want to go to Rodmont," I said, after my eyes had been sealed a half month or longer. "I want to ask Gry to give me a dog." I had to get up my determination to say that, for poor Hamnida and the horrible thing I had made of him were in my mind as if branded into it. But the thought of having a dog to aid my blindness had come to me the night before, and I knew it was a good one, and I longed to talk with Gry. "A dog," Kennick said with surprise. But Mella understood at once and said,
"That's a good idea. I'll ride."
I knew she had been about to say she would ride to Rodmont on my errand, though she was not much of a horsewoman and timid even with Roni. But what she said was,
"I'll ride with you if you like. Can we go tomorrow?"
"Put it off a little while," Kennick said. "It's time we were making ready to go to Drummond." In all that had befallen me, I had utterly forgotten about Brantor Aga and his invitation. The reminder was most unwelcome.
"I can't go now," I said.
"You can," my father said.
"Why should he? Why should we?"
my mother demanded.
"I've said what's at stake."
Kennick's voice was hard.
"A chance of truce, if not of friendship, and the offer may be of a betrothal."
"But Drum won't want to betroth his granddaughter to Auric now."
"Will he not? When he knows Auric can kill at a glance? That his gift is so strong he must seal his eyes to spare his enemies? Oh, he'll be glad to ask, and glad to get what we choose to give. Don't you see that?"
I had never heard that tone of harsh, fierce triumph in my father's voice.
It shook me strangely. It woke me.
For the first time, I realized that my blindfold made me not only vulnerable, but threatening. My power was so great that it could not be released, must be restrained. If I unsealed my eyes, I myself was, like Cattard's staff, a weapon. And I also understood in that moment why so many of the people of the house and the domain treated me as they had done since my eyes were sealed, speaking to me with an uneasy respect instead of the old easy fellowship, falling silent as I came near, creeping past me as if they hoped I couldn't hear them. I thought they shunned and despised me because I was blind. It hadn't occurred to me that they feared me because they knew why I was blind. Indeed, as I was to learn, the tale had grown in the telling, and I had the grisly credit of all kinds of feats. I had destroyed a whole pack of wild dogs, bursting them open like bladders. I had cleared the venomous snakes out of all Caspermont merely by sweeping my eyes over the hills. I had glanced at old Ubro's cottage, and that same night the old man had fallen paralyzed and lost the power of speech. And it was not a punishment, but only the wild gift striking without reason. When I had gone looking for the missing white heifers, the instant I saw them, I had destroyed them against my own will. And so, in fear of this random and terrible power, I had blinded myself, or Kanak had blinded me, though others said no, only sealed his eyes with a blindfold. If anybody disbelieved these tales, they took him to see the ruined hillside above the ash brook. The dead tree, the little broken bones of voles and moles and mice on the waste ground there, the burst boulders and shattered stones. I didn't know these stories then, but it had dawned on me that I had a new power, which lay not in acts, but words, in reputation. "We'll go to Drummond," my father said. "It's time. Day after tomorrow. If we set off early, we can be there by nightfall. Take your red gown, Mella. I want Drum to see the gift he gave me."
"Oh, dear," my mother said. "How long must we stay?"
5 or 6 days, I suppose.
"Oh, dear, dear. What can I take the Branter's wife? I must have some guest present for her."
"It's not necessary."
"It is," said my mother.
"Well, a basket of something from the kitchen?"
"Pah," said my mother. "There's nothing this time of year." "A basket of chicks," I suggested. Mother had taken me into the poultry yard that morning to let me handle a brood of newly hatched chicks, putting them into my hands, cheeping, warm, weightless, downy, prickly.
"That's it," she said.
And when we set off 2 days later, early in the morning, she had a basket full of cheeping on her saddle bow. I wore my new kilt and coat, my man's coat. Because I must ride Roni, she was on Greylag, who was a completely trusty horse, though his height and size scared her. My father rode the colt. He had given much of Branty's training to me and Alec, but when you saw him ride Branty, you saw that he and the colt were made for each other. Handsome, nervous, proud, and rash. I wished I could see him that morning. I longed to see him. But I sat good Roni and let her carry me forward into the dark.